Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Women Leading the Way in Arab Spring conference call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Robin Morgan. Ms. Morgan, the floor is yours.
Good morning, everybody. I'm one of your hosts. I'm here together with my sister and dear friend and co-founder of the Women's Media Center, Gloria Steinem, and we are co-hosting the call in honor of Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi, whom I'll get to in a moment and who is very special. I want to start by saying just a few words about feminism in the Arab world and the Western misconceptions about it, which are considerable, as if it didn't exist, as if it were only a Western import, which sometimes is claimed by male supremacists in the Arab world. There is a vibrant feminist movement in every country of the Arab world, and indeed of the Muslim world, and there always has been. It is, in the Arab world, it's as old as the movement in the United States, late 19th century, and has fought for national and liberation from colonialism revolutions, in many cases, only to be, as in the famous case of Algeria, betrayed after triumph, and told, now it's time for the women to go back to the kitchen. In the Arab Spring, which I swear I think is the greatest gift that the Arabs have given us since vaccination and the fork, women have been incredibly active. I'm not going to talk about the role of women in Egypt, since Nawal is the dean of that, and it, of course, was there herself and inspired it. So I won't talk about Egypt, but I just want to mention a few, touch a few bases before introducing Nawal. In Tunisia, which after all sparked all of this, the very first report on people in the streets and Tunisian protests was a woman blogger, Lina Ben Meheni, as early as late December of last year. And women were very active in the Tunisian protests. There are many incredibly vocal feminists, Raja Bin Salama, who has been taking on the fundamentalist subjugation of women, called for Tunisia's new laws to be based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then was immediately denounced by the exiled head of an Islamist party who was out of the country, who vowed to hang her publicly and has now returned to Tunisia. Not that that's stopping Tunisian feminists. Khadija Charif has said that the force of the Tunisian feminist movement is that we've never separated it from the fight for democracy and for a secular society, which, of course, in honor of International Women's Day, women are fighting for here, as a matter of fact, to keep the society secular. In Yemen, the protests were sparked, this is not getting into the news, by the arrest of 30-year-old Tawakkul Abdel Salam Karman, who is head of a group called Women Journalists Without Chains, a good idea. She has finally been released because of the protests, and her first statement on being released from jail was, "There is no solution to extremism other than spreading the culture of coexistence and dialogue, skills that women master and possess." In Bahrain, Shia women in chadors sat down when fired on with tear gas, and they refused to move until the police were driven away by the caustic fumes. Then the women left. In Algeria, women marched chanting, "Down with the family code." In the Gaza Strip, when Palestinian youth rallied demanding that Hamas and the PLO reconcile, which this morning's paper said they're beginning to consider having dialogue about, and this protest was sparked by a woman, a young journalist named Asma Al-Ghul, who is well known in Gaza for a defiant feminist voice, and who keeps calling openly in Gaza, ruled by Hamas, for a secular Palestinian society. And even less known is that the Libyan revolt, which is, of course, still a source of great anguish and controversy and is still up in the air, it began at the Benghazi Attorney General's office, and it began with a sit-in by lawyers and judges led by, guess who, a woman, Salwa Bougougis, a lawyer in her mid-40s. You know, so you would think from the general press that even during International Women's Month, when they give us a month when there's a whole year, you would think that some of these names would surface, but they haven't, or they haven't very much. But then we come to the mother of them all, who is the great Mel al-Sadawi. Now, I could go on for hours about her because we've been friends and colleagues for near to 40 years, and I love her dearly. But just some facts for those few of you who don't know who she is, because she is probably the most widely translated Arab writer in the world. She was trained as a doctor. She's worked as a psychiatrist and as a university lecturer. She has published almost 50 novels in, I think it's 45 or near that, translations around the world. One of her most famous books was The Hidden Face of Eve, in which she first broke silence about women in the Arab world. Another famous book was Women and Sex, a nonfiction book, which led to her losing her job as Director General of Public Health for the Egyptian Ministry of Health. So she's been a wonderful troublemaker all along. In that book and in her others, she was the first voice to out the practice of FGM, or female genital mutilation. She's taken on religious groups of all fronts, all patriarchal religions, and she has had fatwas and death threats issued against her. She is a brilliant writer, I mean, a really wonderful novelist, and yet a political activist. She has been banned, she's been imprisoned, she's been sent into exile, imprisoned by Sadat, exiled by Mubarak, her books banned, the fatwas visited on her, internal exile, and she has not stopped. I mean, there's a wonderful quote, there's so many of Nawaz, but the one that I will leave with and introduce her to you all on is, "For me," she wrote, "feminism includes everything. It is social justice, political justice, sexual justice. It is the link between medicine, literature, politics, economics, psychology, and history. Feminism is all that." So I am extremely honored to present one of the great ones. And when she has talked for a little bit, then Gloria is going to ask her some questions, and then we'll throw it open the floor for the rest of you. My dear and beloved friend, the great Nawal al-Sadawi.
Thank you so much, Robin. After such a wonderful introduction, sometimes I cannot speak because I don't feel all that, you know. I think any woman can do what I did if she lived my life, you know, oppression. The accumulation of pain and oppression make you revolt and even sacrifice your life. And usually I say, I love freedom very much to the extent I went to prison. You know, this, and I think women all over the world, in the United States, in our region, everywhere, they are fighting, but their struggle is hidden, buried in history. I am happy that I'm here with you and with Gloria, and you represent women here in the United States who are fighting for years, decades, against patriarchy, capitalism, militarism, social justice. So we have the same struggles. We are all in the same boat, whether in the U.S. or Europe or in our region. And this global solidarity is very essential. You did a lot when I was in prison to liberate us, and we do a lot when we hear that something happening in the U.S. So we are all in the same boat. And you did very well. You know, I teach creativity and dissidence, and it's just this linkage, what you said, between literature, politics, economics, sexuality, history, this is creativity and dissidence. And we live in a world that is very unjust. So long we have patriarchy, male domination in the family and in the state. So long we have militarism, that any country, any big army like the U.S. Army can go and invade Iraq or Palestine. Or so we are living not in a really, when the law is unjust, we have to break it. That's dissidence. And it's very, very natural. Democracy, when you said secularism and democracy, yes, I understand secularism. Women cannot be liberated in a religious state. That's why I'm very much against Islamic State or Christian State or Jewish State or any other state governed by religious people. It means discrimination against women and the poor. But democracy now is very confusing. Democracy in my country has a negative resonance when we hear democracy. What's democracy? You cannot have real democracy under patriarchy or capitalism or feudalism or militarism. So we don't have democracy anywhere. I was even censored here in the U.S., you know, when I spoke. Some media censored me, like Anandpour and others. So we are fighting. The slogan of the Egyptian revolution was dignity, justice, freedom. We didn't say democracy. We avoided the word democracy. We say freedom, justice, dignity, equality between all, equality between countries, equality between nations, equality between gender, equality between classes. Without that, women cannot be liberated. This morning, I heard very bad news coming from Cairo about intervention in our countries. You know, there are the Egyptian revolution and the Tunisian revolution inspired many other nations to revolt against dictatorship and colonialism. But what's happening, the counter-revolution is working now. Saudi Arabia, the most corrupt regime, dictators in Saudi Arabia are supported by the U.S., by the United States. Saudi Arabia sent their troops to Bahrain to kill the protesters and prevent the revolution. John McCain came to Cairo. I wonder why he came to Cairo. You know, and Robert Gates and Hillary Clinton, and they met the military. So there is, it's, you know, all those external powers with the internal powers, the Hosni Mubarak men and the military, they are trying to abort the Egyptian revolution. That's what the news, the very, very recent news. So what to do about that? I think women here in the U.S. can really have this support to the women in our region by refusing intervention in the revolutions in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Bahrain, in Jordan, because all those nations are revolting against dictatorship, against colonialism, for social justice. Men and women are fighting together. So I think I am here in the U.S., and I think this global solidarity is very important. Number one, to expose the link between neocolonialism and religious fundamentalism. Usually I say George Bush and Bin Laden are twins. Sadat and Islamic fundamentalism were twins. Mubarak and Muslim Brothers and Islamic fanatics were twins. So they use God against women. They use God against justice and freedom. And that's why we have this revival of religions all over the world. And global solidarity between us is very, very important.
Nawal, thank you. Yeah, I want to tell the listeners that Nawal and I are sitting here at our breakfast table. We are smiling at each other. There's a very human aspect going on here. And I'm feeling, as Nawal is speaking, the special responsibility of feminists and of men of conscience in this country who are responsible for the effect of its actions in other countries. And I hope that when we are discussing, we can get to some very practical actions that we can take here to ensure responsibility and to make sure that this country understands that not to support justice and freedom and dignity is to leave the oil reserves in the hands of a force of government that is now on the wrong side of history, and that by any measure, whether it's conscience or pragmatism, it is very, very important that we figure out how to reach out and support each other across our national boundaries. I just want to say a couple of human things to give you some idea of the force of Nawal's caring. We were having dinner last night, and she was explaining to me that she, a novelist, a wonderful novelist, I might add, and anyone who's listening who is a writer understands the meaning of what I'm about to say. She was in the middle of a very, very important novel. She has, as you know, for all of these years, been out there as an activist, but she's also a novelist. When the revolution began in the streets and new generations began to use new technology to pursue what Nawal has been pursuing all of her life, it so moved her that she said, I cannot continue this novel. I must start a new novel. And so now she is writing a post-revolutionary or during the revolution novel, and for a writer to abandon all those pages tells you where her heart is and how much it truly matters. I also want to offer my personal testimony to the length of the feminist revolution in the Arab world in general, and especially in Egypt, just from much longer than my lifetime, but just from my own lifetime. Which is that when I went to Egypt for the first time in the late 70s, at the invitation of a woman who was running a feminist theater, that is, she was taking traditional folk tales and telling them from the woman's point of view, much against the will of religious fundamentalists, there was arranged to have us both lecturing at American University, and there was some concern and some threat from religious extremist groups that they were going to interrupt the lecture, not allow it to happen, and so on. A woman we had never seen before, who at that time must have been in her 90s, I suspect, who was a feminist from the feminist wave of the early 1900s, and who had thrown her veil into the Mediterranean as part of this demonstration, which I only learned later. This 90-year-old woman just appeared without being asked, came up on the stage with us, sat in a chair with her arms folded, and just sat there to protect us. It is something that brings tears to my eyes now, but it speaks to me of the unity and the not unity, but empathy, I would say. The empathy with our different situations and the way that we can support each other. So here we sometimes say, no women, no democracy. Perhaps that would redeem the word democracy somewhat, so we should continue to say it. But I'm hoping that today, because of the attention and kindness of the people on this call, we can get more practical information into the media about the ways that it's possible to act together. So are there questions for Nawal? Who is the first questioner?
Certainly the floor is open for your questions. If you have a question, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. Again, for a question or comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad.
By the way, while we're waiting, Nawal, even though she's now almost 80, was at Tahrir Square day after day after day, and at one point was almost trampled on by when the horses and camels came in, and has a wonderful story to tell about how a group of young male, in this case protesters, rescued her.
And there's also an excellent YouTube of Nawal for the listeners to tune into in the square, in Liberation Square.
You expect me to answer now, or what?
No, we're waiting
for questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, it takes a moment to.
Okay.
But if there are none yet, then at that point you can tell the story that I love. It's the sandwich story.
yes, the motorcycle. Yeah.
Okay, there are several questions. The first question comes from Karina Bernard. Karina, the floor is yours.
Oh, hello. Thank you very much for having this call. I'm editor of Women's E-News, and I'm actually calling from Massachusetts today. I have a stack of questions, but I think I just want to follow up with Ms. El-Sadawi about this mention of having been censored. Could you tell us more about how you were censored by the media here?
Yes. I have many examples with the TV, ABC, the show of Christiana Anampur on Sunday, and I talked naturally as I talk now, and I made the link between religious fundamentalisms and neocolonialism, George Bush and Bin Laden twins, etc., and this was cut. Also in Portland, when I just came from Portland, I was invited to give a lecture.
Portland, Maine, not Portland, Oregon.
Maine.
Right.
I was invited to give a lecture 2 days ago, and the newspaper, the main newspaper, Portland Press Herald, interviewed me, and I, for 1 hour, and then what appeared was just a little, because they disagreed, and even they said in the piece that they wrote, that they said, though we disagree with her, you know. So it was very strange that the interview was not published. And many others I can give you. Everywhere I was interviewed, in the TV or the radio or the newspapers, they cut whatever they like. They cut whatever they like.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Egypt, exactly. I am censored in Egypt the same time. Maybe in Egypt it's more, that they don't interview me at all in government newspapers. They censor me, so I'm not interviewed. But here I am interviewed, but they cut what I say.
I see. Well, so you think that you're going up against American exceptionalism as a form of anti-democratic influence here?
Yes, I think democracy, as I said, you cannot have real democracy, which is real freedom. And real freedom means equality between people, regardless of anything. That's democracy to me. So if you have poverty, if you have capitalism, if you have militarism, you don't have democracy. So I don't see democracy here in the United States.
Okay, I have more questions, but I can cede the floor if someone else is waiting.
Nawal, this is Robin speaking. Nawal, just for your own information, Women's E! News, which this caller was representing, who's the editor, is an amazing and wonderful organization that is in existence precisely to give the other side of the news, the same kind of work in a different way that the Women's Media Center does, because we do face sexism in our media and exclusionism in our media, and so we are trying to be the alternatives.
Mm-hmm. That's very good.
Okay, I'm still here, but shall I give someone else the floor?
There are other questions. Just a moment. Next question comes from Ari James. Ari, the floor is yours.
Hi, my name is Ariel Jaime, and I'm a student at Purchase College in Purchase, New York. Nawal, I just wanted to say how honored I am to be able to direct a question to you. I read Woman at Point Zero this fall and was greatly moved by the story. My question is, as a male, what advice or encouragement do you have for, as Robin said, men of conscience who want to be agents of change and facilitate the advancement of women's rights around the world?
Yes, you know, you are a man, and you can be very anti-patriarchal, more than some women. You know, usually I give example of Margaret Thatcher and Condoleezza Rice and, you know, and Angela Merkel and all those women who are very more patriarchal than men. So I don't divide people by their biology or genital organs. I divide them by their brains, you know, how they think and how they struggle against injustices. That's my criteria. And in the Egyptian Revolution, I can tell you that the men, the young men who came to my home, and they are friends, and they support women issues more than some of the women who are brainwashed or veiled. Or so it's not a matter of man and woman. It's a matter of how you believe in. So I think, what was your question? Can you repeat it?
No, I mean, you partially answered it, and I guess my question was just sort of, you know, what advice would you give to men to be exactly that, you know?
Advice to give it to who?
Men.
To men.
What to do.
What advice to men? Well, just to obey your conscience, your heart. For me, you know, God to me, like my peasant grandmother, God is my conscience. It's not a book. God is not the Quran or the Bible. God is my conscience, what I feel. So as a man, there are many men who feel very much the injustices and the oppression women live under: patriarchy, capitalism, feudalism, neocolonialism. And they are against that. There are many feminist men who are really fighting with us. I am fighting all the time with men. In our Arab Women Solidarity Association, we had 40% men. So I don't have any advice except just you follow your heart, your conscience.
Well, thank you, and I am proud to be among your ranks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question comes from Carolyn Alexander. Carolyn, the floor is yours.
Oh, hi. I'm calling from Bloomberg News, and I was just wondering, you were so excited and hopeful at the start of the Egyptian Revolution, and I'm just wondering if some of that optimism is now gone, and can you talk to us a little bit more about this counter-revolution that you mentioned at the beginning?
I am still optimistic. I never lose hope, because hope is power. Usually two things are power: knowledge and hope. And all my life I'm trying to have more knowledge, and all my life I'm hopeful and optimistic. Even in prison, I told my colleagues, Sadat will die and we will survive, and that's what happened. So the counter-revolution now is great, yes. When Robert Gates, why should the military minister of defense, American, go to Cairo and meet the military? What's between them, you know? And John McCain, the Republican, most reactionary man, I followed the campaign between John McCain and Obama. I was here a visiting professor in Atlanta, and I was not convinced at all by John McCain, and I liked Obama, of course, and I encouraged my students and my colleagues to vote for Obama, though he disappointed all of us. But anyway, I am still hopeful, and because I lived with the young men and women who initiated the revolution in Egypt and who slept in Tahrir Square for more than 2 weeks, day and night, under the rain, in the cold, and against Mubarak regime and his men, and persisted till Mubarak resigned, Mubarak was ready to burn Egypt, exactly like Gaddafi. Gaddafi is ready to burn Libya to be in power. And he is now supported, Gaddafi, by many external powers for the oil. And Mubarak also was supported by external powers. But those men and women, the Egyptian revolution inspired Wisconsin. You know, in Wisconsin, they said, walk like an Egyptian. So inspired everybody. So they will never lose, I am sure, because I lived with them, I know them. The Egyptian revolution will win, and nobody can abort it.
Now, while it might be helpful, I've heard you discuss this before, for the listeners on the call, it might be helpful for you to address the question of under counter-revolution, of the fact that the military formed an all-male committee to rewrite the Constitution without a single woman on it, and there was a major statement by Egyptian women's organizations that 63 of them signed on to, and that you've now begun reviving the Pan-Arab Women's Solidarity. So that we know maybe if you could talk about what women are doing on that counter-revolutionary front.
Yes. In fact, I would like to say men and women in Egypt, especially young men, many, many young men came to my home because I am always in contact with younger generations in Egypt. They read my books, and I feel one with them. We understand each other. So those men were very angry, the young men and also the young women, but the men were more angry with the military council who established a committee with no women and no young people. They were eight old men. They were legal experts or something like that to make some cosmetic changes for the Constitution. So we were very angry, very angry, and we decided in my home with all those, there were about 55 or more young men and women, mainly men, we decided two things. To re-establish the Egyptian Women Union, which was banned several times by Suzanne Mubarak and Jihan Sadat. We re-established it. We considered all the young men and women there to be the founding members of the Egyptian Women Union, because without unity between women, we cannot do anything. And then also the idea came from the young men that there should be a million march of women and men on the 8th of March in Cairo. And this happened, but of course, some people said that they were attacked by gangs of Mubarak, etc. But the march succeeded, and there was some attacks, but they failed, because the attacks is going on all the time. Since the 25 January till today, there are gangs who are attacking the revolutionary people. But we won. We established the Egyptian Women Union. The march happened. It was a little bit aborted, but it will continue, and we will continue. And now, just today, my daughter emailed me and said that the revolutionary people, the millions, are refusing all the decisions by the military high council, including these cosmetic changes of the Constitution and the collaboration with the American Army, all that. And they are refusing that, and they are insisting that all their demands should be met.
This is Gloria just adding that if the reporters on the line look at the results from the group brought together to arrive at a new constitution, they will find one of its provisions is that the president cannot have a foreign-born wife. Consequently, that is de facto evidence that the constitution they're talking about is not democratic, because they have already made clear that the president can only be a male. This is part of what inspired the idea of the march.
And it's really ridiculous to insist that the president should not have a foreign wife. So what? So what? You know, it's ridiculous. And many other restrictions. One of it that the item 2 of the Constitution says that Islam is the religion of Egypt. And Christians and progressive Muslims, even some of the Muslim younger generations of Muslim brothers and secular young people, they are refusing this item. They say it should be omitted. A country should not have a religion. A country should be secular for all to be equal.
The next question, or...
Next question comes from Sanez Meshkinpour. Sanez, the floor is yours.
Hi, this is Sanaz Meshkinpour. Thank you so much for having this call and this opportunity to hear from you, Nawal, and ask you questions. I
can't hear you. Can you?
I'll speak louder.
Can you raise your voice?
Yes, I can speak. Is this better?
Yes, that's
okay.
Much better.
I was thanking you for the opportunity to hear from you and to ask questions. I'm calling from National Public Radio in Washington. I wanted to ask you, you spoke about the visit by Robert Gates, John McCain, Hillary Clinton to Egypt and about Saudi Arabia's intervention in Bahrain. I want to ask you about your thoughts on the situation in Libya and the decision-making going on in the international community about military intervention, what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I am against, not only me, most of the people in Egypt and in Libya and in our region, they don't like foreign intervention. Because, you know, why should a country send its troops to another country? The Egyptian army does not come here and interfere in American affairs. So why should the U.S. Army go to Egypt and interfere, or to Libya, or to Bahrain? Our problem in our region is the oil. Is the oil. If we don't have oil in Iraq, in Libya, in Bahrain, in the Gulf, nobody will interfere. So the interference, foreign interference, other countries' interference in our life, in our countries, is related to oil, material benefits. It's not for democracy. When George Bush invaded Iraq and burnt Baghdad and killed the Iraqi people. You see Iraq how, Iraq now. You know, when he did it under the name of democracy or human rights or even women rights, as if George Bush is a feminist. So I am against all that. And it's common sense. Do you like other country army to interfere in your country? It's something we have to manage. We have to get rid of our own dictators by ourselves. And the Egyptian revolution got rid of Mubarak by themselves. We were not helped by America or anybody. The Egyptian, the millions, 20 million men and women were in the streets, and Mubarak had to resign. So why don't they leave us alone?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question comes from Jihan Harney. Jihan, the floor is yours.
Noel, I'm actually Egyptian-American, and I'm so proud of you and your work, and I saw you on TV when you were talking from Tahrir Square about the revolution. And I'm also a filmmaker and a journalist, and I hope I can, be inspired more from your work in order to make more of a difference through my work and as a fellow of the Women Media Center as well. My question is about the Muslim Brotherhood right now. I understand there is, an imminent vote on the constitutional amendments and that a lot of Egyptians are against it because, like what you said, it's mainly cosmetic. But if they don't, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces said that if this opportunity passes by, they're going to introduce, re-examine amendments again, and this time it's not going to be subject to for people to vote. They're going to do it no matter what. And simultaneously, the Muslim Brotherhood are solidifying their grip and their partnership with other groups and reaching out to different parts of Egypt, especially the, you know, poor areas, mm-hmm. you know, handing food, trying to get people to, you know, get you know, vote. So the more votes there are, the better. What do you think will happen next if people don't vote, Muslim Brotherhoods and their own people vote, and they solidify their power more? What's going to happen next, and what should Egyptians do?
The power of people will win, because the Muslim Brothers, you know, their role was exaggerated. Islamophobia.
Sure.
In fact, yes, Islamophobia is a political phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with Islam. We discovered when we lived more than 2 weeks in Tahrir Square that, the number one, the Muslim Brothers did not start the revolution. Even they were against it at the beginning, and they didn't participate. When the revolution won, they came to Tahrir Square. So they came very late. They are minority. Of course, they tried to dominate, but they couldn't, because the majority were secular. Even, I tell you, the younger generations of the Muslim Brothers are secular, and they don't believe in an Islamic state, the younger generations. And they are against, there is a split in the Muslim Brothers between the leaders, traditional leaders, who refuse to have a woman as a president or a Copt, a Christian. They declared no women, no Copts as a president. But the younger generations of the Muslim Brothers, who are the majority, are against that. And you can imagine that when I went to Tahrir Square, I was welcomed by the younger generations of Muslim Brothers. They hugged me, hundreds of them. They came around me and said, oh, we read your work, we admire you, but we disagree with some of what you say, but we respect you, and we believe in a secular constitution, secular family code, secular state, secular Egypt. So there is this big Islamophobia that try to exaggerate. The Muslim Brothers are minority in Egypt. They are not the majority. Of course, they can play on the illiteracy of the people and the political illiteracy more and try to dominate. They are trying to do that now.
Mm-hmm.
And I received an email from some people, some friends, saying that they are using Islamic slogans now. There was not an Islamic slogan in the revolution.
Yeah.
Not an Islamic. It was dignity, justice, freedom.
Mm-hmm.
No Islamic. Now they are trying to put some Islamic slogans, but the young men and women are aware, and they are the majority. So I am not afraid. I am not afraid at all, as I told you. I have confidence in this revolution.
One other thing, you know, by the way, my brother participated in the revolution, and he was there, and he spent nights in Tahrir Square, and I wish I could
really?
Be with
your
him.
Brother?
Yes, yes. I still have family in Egypt.
Okay.
And, and as an Egyptian American woman here, what advice can you give me in order to be of more to, you know, effect to support, you know, the solidarity of women, and particularly what's happening in Egypt and the Arab world?
Yes. If you can come to Cairo, you are welcome. If you cannot come,
so now
yes.
You're based in Cairo, خلاص.
if you can, if you have to live here, then you cooperate and coordinate with the feminist movement here,
mm-hmm.
with Robin and Gloria, because we live in one world.
Sure.
And especially women, we are all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
So if you fight here against the same struggle, and for the same goals, freedom, justice, equality, and especially equality between countries, independence, end of capitalism, militarism, neocolonialism, religious fundamentalism. You have many things to fight against here.
Mm-hmm.
Then you are helping us.
Mm-hmm.
This is Robin. I just want to add a PS to what Nawal said. Marhaba, and because clearly you also want to do all of that, but be more directly involved with what women are doing in the region. And I don't know if you know about it yet, but it's relatively new. But it is a regional young feminist action alliance called Women United for the Future of the Middle East.
Mm.
And yeah, and I will very slowly give you their, well, they're on Facebook. They have a page on Facebook. So it's facebook.com/pages. Then with hyphens between each of these words, women-united-for-the-future-of-the-middle-east-March 8th, and they were formed on March 8th for demonstrations. And you can also just simply Google them, and they are terrific and young and using the new technology and social media to network women from all over the world in support of what women in the region are doing.
And also, please email me. Robin, you have my email. Give my email to our friend from Egypt so that I connect you with all groups in men and women in Cairo who are working in the revolution.
Fantastic.
And yes, and who went in the March of 8th March and who are working till today. So connect me also, and then we need to network.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I definitely look forward to it, and when I visit Egypt, hopefully in the fall, hopefully I can see you in person too.
Good, and come and visit me.
Akid.
Ma'asalam.
Thank you. Next question comes from Gordon McKenzie. Gordon, the floor is yours.
Nawal, thank you so much for the important work that you do, and also Gloria and Robin. I know that in the revolution, one of the things you're talking about, that there isn't a democracy, and the focus on that is off, and I couldn't agree with you more. What role do lesbian, gay, transgendered, differently gendered folks play in the revolution, and how do you see this as tied in to really bringing equality and freedom for people that are different? By the way, I'm from gender education and media, and also the chair of a women's and gender studies program. We're bringing out Mona Elta Howey as our speaker in a couple weeks from Egypt.
So your question is what?
What role are lesbian, gay, transgender people? And I don't want to impose the U.S. definitions in terms of people being different. But when we talk about equality for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, usually I say religion and sexual life is very, very, it's your choice, private.
Yes.
Whether you like to pray or to believe in our goddess Isis or Nut.
I do. Or and to, and
or
some of the
whether
other
you choose another goddess or another male god. It's up to you.
Yes.
It's up to you. If you want to have women friends or women lovers or men lovers, it's up to you.
Yeah.
And so we shouldn't kill each other because of that.
So
we shouldn't hate each other. Many of my friends are homosexual, lesbians, are atheists, religious, etc., but we love each other.
That's right.
So we need this stage. We need a stage in history in which sex, religion, etc., should be a little bit or so be away.
Yeah.
From our social, political, and public life. Though, I think this is just transitory period in history, because I don't separate the private from the public.
And
the personal
so
is political.
Yes,
I don't separate. But we need this phase, because people are so indulged in this sexual preference, religious differences, and they kill each other and hate each other. So we need a transit period until psychologically we get rid of these differences and we accept each other as we are.
Yeah, and that we have full human rights for everyone.
Yes.
Again, thank you for the work you continue to do.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Tammy at Emmy. Tammy, the floor is yours. Tammy, if your phone is muted, please unmute your phone. Okay, next question comes from Carla Morgenstein. Carla, the floor is yours. Carla, the floor is yours.
Okay, over here.
Okay, next question comes from Sarah Ratt. Sarah, the floor is yours.
Hello. Thank you very much for organizing this, and thank you very much, Nawal, for sparing time answering our questions. I teach political science and women's studies at Purchase College, and I use your writings and in my classes. I have to say that you have quite a few fans out here. And my question might have been answered, I don't know, because my connection was bad and I was disconnected a couple of times. But it's about the U.S. intervention and the military rule in Egypt at the time. I am Irio Boss, that is, I share your concerns. And however, giving this recognizing certain facts that U.S. Has considerable leverage over the military, Egyptian military, and which is in power at the moment, can the U.S. use that leverage not for military intervention, but to pressure the current government to be more open and inclusive for, again, all parties involved in the revolution, particularly the women, and incorporating women's rights into the Constitution?
In fact, I didn't get your point. You meant that I didn't understand. Can you tell me, Gloria, what did you say?
Since the United States has leverage with the military in Egypt, can the U.S. use that leverage to influence the military to allow the democratic process?
Well, it's against the interests, against the American interest. Why should the America army work against their interest? This revolution is not, it doesn't go hand in hand with the interest of America and Egypt. I want to ask you, America wants what from Egypt, you know? America wants what from Iraq, from Libya? What's the interest of another country in another country? So we have to ask ourselves, why should they use this? America pay $2 billion to the military in Egypt. Why? And those $2 billion, where they go? Not to the people. Where they go? You know, and we have to read history. The British colonialism did the same. French colonialism did the same. Dutch colonialism did the same. So we have to understand that no country can really pay such money and use its military in another country for the interest of the other country. It's for their own interest. You know, why should they pay all this money for the interest of another people? So it's common sense.
Thank you. In many ways, actually, I share your opinion, but I wanted to also hear from you. Because, again, especially my students who feel very much connected to people in Egypt, yet feeling unable to do anything. And the only thing they have is to, within limited means, but they can pressure the government here for some changes. And so they've been asking me about this, and so that's why I posed the question to you.
I would like to add, very important, that this USA, American aid to countries in Egypt, in Africa, is disastrous. I think the Americans should cut the aid to Egypt. We don't need this aid, because this aid does not go to the poor. It goes to the ruling class. It corrupts the ruling class. it encourages the dictators in our countries to kill us, this money, this American aid. So America, what I would like to pressurize in here, that America should not send aid to any country. Usually we say fair trade and not aid. We need equality, not aid. We are not beggars. We can produce our food. But since Sadat came to power, he accepted the aid. He used the aid against the people. He killed the national production, food production. We don't produce our food in Egypt. Even full madamas, even bread, we import wheat from America. We import full madamas from California. And this created increasing poverty and unemployment in our country. That's neocolonialism. So, in fact, there's a lot for you here in America to do to stop this aid and to start to speak about equality, justice between countries and not aid. It's very humiliating when somebody tells me, Nawal, you are from Egypt. You know, Egypt takes $2 billion, the biggest aid after Israel. It's a slap on my face that Egypt, my country, take aid from another country. Though we can produce our food, our agriculture, we are prevented from producing our food.
This is Gloria. Your students might be interested in seeing a documentary called Inside Job, which actually won the Academy Award for feature-length documentary this year, and which is a very well-reported expose of the ways in which the lack of regulation of the financial structure in this country ends up with speculation on, say, wheat and raises the cost of wheat in Egypt. In other words, the wheat, instead of being produced in Egypt, is raised in price, speculated upon, and ends up being a profit center for profiteers, financial profiteers here. It's quite an amazing expose.
I know. Thanks.
Yeah.
Have more questions?
Again, for a question or comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. The next question comes from Nalika. Excuse me, Nalika, the floor is yours.
Hi, thank you so
much. I can't hear you. Please come near the mic.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes, better.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much for speaking about what's going on. My name is Nalika, and I'm from the National Democratic Institute, and my question concerning the women's coalitions and alliance groups that you have been talking about, the Egyptian Women Union and the Women United for the Future of the Middle East. And I was wondering about two things. One, how effectively have younger women who have just come out into being active in this, you know, in this revolution, how effectively have they been able to partner and work with older and more established women's groups to form these coalitions?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Secondly, how do you see these coalitions putting pressure on the military to kind of really engage with the constitutional
mm-hmm.
drafting process and really try to get back into the
mm-hmm.
circles of discussion around?
Very, very good question.
Thank you.
You know what happened? Divide and rule. We were very strong, the feminist movement and the women movement. We were united, very strong, and we started the Arab Women Solidarity Association, and it was banned. It was banned, and Jihani Sadat and Suzanne Mubarak killed the feminist movement and divided. There was divisions among the women groups in Egypt. And when they closed, when they banned our association, which we had 3,000 members, and we were very effective, and we created a debate, a new debate about women issues related to global politics and internal politics, So they wanted to divide us, and that's why the Sadat and Mubarak were against me especially, because I was among the leaders of this new wave of the feminist movement in Egypt. To the extent now, I was totally, of course, isolated from the media. I was censored. My books were censored. I put in prison. I was in exile. They polluted, they distorted my image by creating rumors about me that I am atheist, I'm against God, I am against the country, I am westernized, I'm a betrayer, a traitor, and all. But this did not work, because my books are in every home. I have 47 books in Arabic in Egypt, in every home, and in the Arab world. So my reputation was good, and younger people started to be attracted to me. 4 or 5 generations, they were reading my books. But my organization was dissolved and banned. I worked as an individual, and I tried to have connection all the time with younger generation. But the older generation, when they banned the Arab Women's Solidarity, this was in 1991, when we stood against the Gulf War, and we said women issues are not separate from war and colonialism. We connected that. Mm-hmm. When they banned us in Egypt, many NGOs were created. That's the problem. Okay. Many NGOs were created pro-Sadat, pro-Mubarak, and they were working with Suzanne Mubarak and with Jihan Sadat against us, against feminism, against real women liberation. And this created a problem. Can you imagine that those NGOs, they have a coalition now. I don't know, they are many, but maybe 25 of them. Mm-hmm. They made a statement against the Women March. Against the Women March. And they said, oh, why should we speak about women now? It's not the time. This may divide. This is so and so. We have to listen to the military council, and etc. And they were against the Women March. So you see how the effect of Sadat and Mubarak and Jihan Sadat and Suzanne Mubarak on the feminist movement, it was killed and divided. And they banned the Egyptian Women Union. That's why we started by reestablishing the Egyptian Women Union to unite the feminist movement, to fight against those so-called NGOs who are now having a loud voice, and they are supported by the government.
And now, this is Robin. Nawal, maybe you could speak for a moment on the integration of the more established groups, the good ones like yours, with younger women who are using social media and the new technology in all of these creative and amazing ways.
That's happening now, and it's making me very happy. You know, this is one of the very good effects of the revolution, that now the men who initiated the Women March were using the Facebook, bloggers, the YouTube, and all that, and they came to my home, many, many of them, and this technology, they started the Women March. So now we are reuniting me, my older generations, women like me and men, with the very young people, 25, from 25 to 40, who are working with Facebook and YouTube. We are united now, and we work together. And that's the positive, one of the very positive effects of the revolution.
Thank you. Next question comes from Karina Bernard. Karina, the floor is yours.
Yeah, hi, this is Karina Bernard again. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to go back a little bit. Mr. Dawi has a very fundamental international geopolitical power critique, and that's good to hear and to get familiar with. On top of that, when you pull out the things that women's groups hear focus on, such as the lack of women in the, you know, the councils that have been named, and the lack of women in the Constitutional Framing Committee. Those things are being focused on from this part of the world, but I don't hear you focusing on those things. Are they not important to you, or are they not fundamental to you?
The women's rights?
The lack of women in the Constitutional Framing Committee.
Yes, of course.
This is an important issue.
Of course, women are half the society, and the women participated in the revolution, and they were killed in Tahrir Square, and they slept day and night for more than 2 weeks in Tahrir Square. I saw mothers.
So why are they? Why have they not made it into the Constitutional Framing Committee?
Why the military did not include women?
Yeah.
Well, it's natural. Patriarchy. The military are all men. Patriarchal men, military mentality.
Okay, so if I can press this a little bit, are the revolutionaries, is this of broad concern to the revolutionaries in Egypt at this point?
Yes, especially, you know, I told you that many, many of the young men and women who initiated the revolution and who started the revolution and continued and persisted until Mubarak resigned and persisting till today. They are secular. They are with women's rights. They are for radical change of the constitution, for omitting item 2 that say that Egypt is an Islamic country. It's there. Of course, the military doesn't want that. The external power doesn't want that. But it's a struggle. And the struggle is going on. Young men and women are for inclusion of women. We made a statement, in fact, when we established the Egyptian Women Union. We made a statement and we said, what are our goals? That women should be represented at least 35% in all new committees to be established to change the constitution, or in the temporary government, or in any change, because now we are asking for a presidential council. We don't want election of president now, because we will have another Mubarak. We said we need a council, a very big, broad council, to be the presidential council. We need to have a very big forum to change the constitution. So we need to do all that before we make elections and to change the law of the political parties and the law of the associations. The old law of the association permit Mubarak to ban our organization and our women union. So we want to change all that, all these laws, and to change the constitution. And then we can make elections to have a better parliament.
I see. Mm-hmm. And let me ask you one more thing by you. As we see the transitional...
Raise your voice.
Okay, I'm just, you know...
Yes, come near the mic, yes.
Okay, when you read about revolutionaries breaking in to military headquarters, stealing secret files, and so forth, you see that these are all young men, and it seems almost like it's almost like the guys have to go raid the military. It's sort of male work. Is this a wrong perception on my part?
The majority are men, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You mean that the majority of the revolutionary people are men, young men?
I would shrink myself from going up against a military. I don't want to be involved with weapons and militaries and, you know, violent guys.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't help wondering if it's realistic to expect women to be, as the struggle right now is very much against the military power, is it realistic that we're going to have full representation of our gender in this transitional moment? That's what I'm kind of wondering.
Well, the military control now is temporary. You know, when Mubarak left and he said that he leaves the power to the High Council of the military, they came and said, we are here temporary for 6 months only, and then we will leave for a civil civil state, secular state, civil government, not military, not military. That's what they said. But of course we don't know. We don't know. It's a struggle.
And it's also the view from here that the military is pretty much throughout the economy. So it's not, no one really here seems to be thinking the military will back all the way out from widespread influence.
Yes. And also they received $2 billion from the U.S.
Yeah, I got that was a very good point you made earlier.
They receive John McCain.
Yeah.
And they receive Robert Gates, and they talk to them and plan with them. So it's very confusing and very bad. But the young people in Egypt, the people who made such a wonderful historical revolution, are not naive. And they know all that. What I told you now, we all say it in Egypt. Young people say it. It's well known. No secrets now. Everybody
right.
know.
You're talking about no aid, watch oil,
yes.
all the fundamental geopolitical reasons that get fogged over
yes.
often is what
yes.
you're saying is very obvious now politically there.
Yes,
yeah.
yes,
okay.
yes. As I said, knowledge and unity, knowledge and hope
mm-hmm.
and unity is power.
Okay.
And everybody knows that now, yes.
Okay, thank you.
You are welcome.
Thank you. Next question comes from Carla Morgenstern. Carla, the floor is yours.
Hi, good morning. I'm going to try this again. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much for this really important conference call. You know, this kind of question kind of plays off of what Robin Morgan was saying about social media. You know, in the current situation, the wonderful technology of that anybody just about can be a broadcaster, and my dream to kind of bring diverse views together.
Mm-hmm.
How can you offer some sort of personal advice and inspiration on how to keep the message alive? And, you know, of course, you know, there's the media goes to very, you know, important events like what's happening in Japan. But when things kind of come back,
mm-hmm.
how do we keep it going?
Yes, yes, it's a good question. It depends what media, because the powerful media is funded by money. That's why they censor us in America or anywhere. That's the media.
But she's talking about our media. This kind
of about American media?
No. About Facebook and how can we use...
How can we use the new technology? Yes, how can we use the Facebook?
Mm-hmm.
To continue with it. But also, it's not important... Because sometimes this new technology is isolating. Young men and women are sitting behind a computer and communicating with others through the media, this new technology, through the Facebook, but they don't see each other. And that's why I have meetings regularly in my home. We need also personal contact and challenges to ideas and criticism. This is done also in the Facebook. They do that, they have questions, they have answers, they have criticism, etc. in the Facebook. But I am for that, but also not to forget that personal meetings and to meet together and to have unions, we need unions. Like in Wisconsin now, the struggle for the working class union, women unions, young people unions, to sit together and look to each other and discuss is very important. So we have to combine this new technology with the personal meetings.
And Carla, this is Gloria. Nawal and I have been, in a way, asking each other this question. And as you know so well, stories, narratives are often the key. So if we can serve here to multiply knowledge of the stories that are going on in the new groups, you know, united across women's groups, united the pan-Arab groups, but individual stories, I think that they fly through the web and will keep the feelings and the sense of identification and empathy alive.
I think we have time for only maybe a couple more questions.
Again, for a question or comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on the telephone keypad.
Or if there are none.
Yes, we've passed our 12:15.
Have indeed.
Yeah, deadline.
Well, Nawal, thank you so much. And thanks to the people who called in, if any of them are still there. It was really very interesting and exciting. And it is a use of technology in a way that is revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, and Jana, thank you, and the Women's Media Center for doing all the work for this. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you very much. I hope you come to Cairo.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my God, my ear.
Thank you. That does conclude today's teleconference. We appreciate your participation. You may now disconnect your line at this time.
Thank you. Thanks, Jana.